Aviva's husband, David, and I were speaking last night, actually, about Yitzhak Berkowitz. Yitzhak Berkowitz is, I mean, he's even more amazing than I thought. he probably still does, but when he was with Eishet Torah, he said he had numerous shirim, I don't know, two dozen a week, probably, and several a day. And he would just come in and start, and an hour later leave, because he'd have to go to another shir, right? That's like, that was, his whole day was like that. And he would, and what David was saying, he was in his shir for a while. And I knew he never used notes. I knew that, which is amazing in and of itself, because he gives detail after detail after detail. But what I didn't know is this, that he would come in, sit down, no notes, and start exactly where he had left off the previous day. You know, exactly. And he'd cover on halacha, and he would do this on the next year, and the next year. So it's hard enough to do that for one class, but to do that on multiple classes that meet at different times of the week. Hey, what you doing here, buddy? you'll be sorry, man. You'll be really sorry. Okay. So I'm like that. Have to use notes. Have to know what I'm doing. Usually half the time I have no idea where I am or who I am for that matter. So I will be using my notes. Thank you very much. We talked last time about the Rishonim. And we talked about Rashi, we talked about the Rambam, we talked about the Rosh, the Rif, the great Rishonim. And we mentioned that they were great in many, many ways, but what we owe them the most for is that they wrote things down. Because you may notice that the Gaonim had very little, and other than the Gemara itself, the great Tanaim and Amoraim, you know, there's no notes we have of them, there's no, like, you know, Rabbi Kiva's notes, you know, we don't have that, right? So, other than, which I don't mind to put down the Mishnah, the Gemara, but there's Toseftas and there's Bryces, but they're as challenging to look through, if not more so, than the Gemara itself, and usually, and very few people really study them itself. It's just the Brises that the other stuff that the Tanaim wrote that happened to make their way into the Gemara. That's how we usually know
what
about
is
a Brisa.
Tanaim?
A Tana is
a Tana means
a
Bible.
No. A Tanakh. You're thinking right. Yeah. You're thinking of Tanakh, right? Which is an acronym: Torah, Nevi'im, Kesuvim. Right. So that's three letters, and I mean that's what Tanakh is. Tana literally means to learn. Those who learn, or those who repeat, because they would know things by heart. So those are the people, the men of the Mishnah. So that's starting with Shimon HaTzadik, which, you know, it's the very, it's like, it started, I guess you could say, in the Greek when the Greek Empire was spreading still, and it ended about 100 years after the destruction of the temple. The Mishnah was written by, well, it was redacted, it was put together by Yehuda Nasi, right, Rabbeinu Kodesh, and that was somewhere in the year between 150 and 200. He died about 192. In fact, his Yahrzeit's coming up. I just sent the Yahrzeit that I sent out. His Yahrzeit, I think, is today or tomorrow.
Avrevi?
Yeah, Avrevi. Okay, so that's the Tanaim. The Amoraim came after them.
Amoraim,
or you know what it literally means, when it says in the Gemara uses that word, it means they were like the mouthpieces. They were like there were no loudspeakers, you know, of course. So they would just repeat. The shir was this person was going, blah, 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 and next to him he would say, and the Rebbe said, you know, and he would say it in other words perhaps. And so those are the original Amoraim. But those are the ones that basically studied the Tanaim and explained the Tanaim, and they were the next 300 years until about the year 500. The Talmud was closed at that point in time, and that was the end. Okay, and last week we talked about the Rishonim, the early commentators. A Rishon means the first, right? Rishonim means the first or the early commentators. And so we finished talking about that, all right? And we left off with Joseph Caro. He wrote a couple of important books. The first he wrote, I remember when I mentioned, he wrote the Beis Yosef. That's a commentary. I don't have him with me there next door, but it's a commentary on the Tur. Remember that the Tur was the Tur. You can get the notes of the tape later. We won't get through if we have to repeat everything from last week. I'm sorry.
Okay.
But the Tur was Arishon. Okay. And he was the first to organize all halacha and all oral law into four sections, and it was, and the important thing, it was relevant only to today's Jew. There was nothing on karbanos, on offerings, sacrifices, on purity and impurity issues, other than that's what's relevant for today. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole business about you can't touch kachim, you can't touch truma, and that's, none of that was in there. And none of the agricultural laws was in there, only for chutz la'aretz, because very few Jews live in Israel then, very, very few. There was never a time in the history of, well, since the Jews came after, since Joshua, that there were no Jews in Israel. But there, it was not a place of study. There were always holy people living there somewhere, but there were not many. So it was really meant for the masses, and the 99% of the Jews live outside of Israel. So that was the tour. Okay? What Beis Yosef did was write a running commentary to the tour. You still get it when you get the, if you buy the tour, then you'll get on the side the Beis Yosef right on it, right? And it's, and not only is it a commentary, but he brings all many other Rishonim, and he says differently, he says like him, and so on and so forth, right? But it was a masterpiece and lengthy, and he wrote it when he was 24 years old. Like, what have you been doing, right? So he can you imagine? He wrote that when he was 24, but it took many, many more years for him to write what is considered his greatest gift to us, which is the Shulchan Aruch, which is really just an abridged version of the Beis Yosef. What he did was he took the Beis Yosef and kind of said, let's cut all the commentary, what's the halacha l'maisa, and whenever there was more than like a controversial issue, he would take best two out of three amongst the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rosh. The Rosh being the father of the Torah. So most of what the tour got and brought down was his father, although not always, but, you know, obviously he had a lot of the Mesorah of his father, a lot of the tradition of his father. Okay, so that's the Shulchan Aruch. Now, by the way, the Shulchan Aruch was the first Sefer, the first Jewish book printed on the Gutenberg Bible, the Gutenberg Press, right? So shortly after the Gutenberg Bible. Everything else beforehand, of course, was handwritten. Mm-hmm. So this was a breakthrough, obviously, for all of world history, but all for us too.
What, 1456?
The 16 something.
16th century.
Oh.
So we're in the 16th century, right? Okay. Now, another man came along about the same time, Rav Moshe Isserles, and we refer to him as an acronym, the Ramah. I'll spell it the way I spell it, but you'll see it all kinds of spelling. It's R-E-M-A, but you'll see R-E-M-O or R-A-M-O or, R, you know, it's, but it's Ramah. Rev Moshe Isserles. So that would be Resh Mem Aleph. Right? So he lived in Germany. He lived entirely in the 16th century. He lived a short life. He passed away in 1572. Rabbi Yosef Karo passed away in 1575. So they were contemporaries, even though he was younger than Rabbi Yosef Karo. He also wrote a very comparable type of book, but he decided, instead of just redoing the whole project, he would just amend the Shulchan Aruch as it was written with Ashkenazic minhagim. Okay? Because if you think about it, Rosakar was a Sephardi, first of all, but he was what's called an Achron, so he was not a Rishon, he was not an early commentator. And he used two out of three who were Sephardi. The Rif was a Sephardi, the Rambam was a Sephardi, the Rosh was in Germany, so he was an Ashkenaz. So it was unfair. So the Ramah came and kind of didn't comment at all if there was no disagreement. But if the custom in Ashkenaz was different, he came and explained. And sometimes he'll say, in our countries, this is what we do. Or something like that. And that's what he means. So therefore, it became a universal bottom line, which was what made it so great. That's why you hear, you know, recited all the time. Because everyone holds by that, pretty much. With very, like Yemenites, for example, hold usually by the Rambam, but it's unusual. Pretty much, when people say the Shulchan Aruch, what they mean is the Shulchan Aruch with the Ramah. I think you'd have a hard time finding a Shulchan Aruch without a Ramah. You'd have to really look for it.
So he redefined the Shulchan Aruch? He redefined it, made it clearer? I'm not clear what.
Okay. Can you go next door and get a Shulchan Aruch? Or just, you know. Yeah. Is that possible? Thank you, Arnie.
Sorry,
okay. I'll show you what it is, but it's basically you'll see Shulchan Aruch, word, and then a different font, usually brief, but sometimes it's like a couple lines. And that's the Ramah. So he'll say something like, however, yada, 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 and so on and so forth. But what he's doing there is explaining that's true in some cases, but not in all cases. And in such cases, this is the halacha. So he might change what the halacha is. Because, you know,
it's all to make it more understandable to the next generation? Is that
No, that's not what he's doing. That's a good question, so I'm glad I must have been not clear. It's not to make it more understandable. It's to make it true for Ashkenazic reference. There are many times in which Sephardi custom, remember it's all in the Surah, right? And the Sephardi, and it wasn't like, you know, international travel so much. People who live in Sephard, thank you. Excellent. Okay. It's a question Mishpat, that's fine. Okay, so you'll see, for example, well, let's look at it closely, because you'll see here, without even reading it, this is one font, and then you'll see there's another font here. Mm-hmm. This other font is the Brahma.
Right inside of it.
Yeah, usually it starts Hey Gimel Hey, which is Hagaos, which is the amendations of Ha Rama, of the Rama. Okay, so that's, you'll see it's usually Haga, it's Hey Gimel Hey. And then you'll see there's other words. And sometimes they'll do this kind of stuff, where he actually brings his source. That's the Rosh.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, so sometimes he'll even bring his source.
So it's different to
he
like
does
what
here
we were
too.
Looking last week when Tothos on Nisa and Riff on...
Right, he did that intentionally, because he doesn't want you to think of this as a commentary. It's not a commentary. He agrees with everything the Shulchan Aruch says, except for those unusual cases or specific cases.
So again, more related to Ashkenazi and Sephardic.
Right. That's the Shulchan Aruch.
Uh-huh.
And then, Hey Gimel Hey. That's Rashi script.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Aval, however, im lo ma'amran kach, if he didn't say it like that, however it is. Okay, so he's bringing in specific situations that are unique to Ashkenaz. Mm-hmm. So as an Ashkenazi Jew, you pick up the Shulchan Aruch. You have to read the Shulchan Aruch because the Rama is generally saying, like this one, for example. However, if he says this, what does that mean? So you have to read the Shulchan Aruch. What's the case we're talking about? Right? And then you go, oh, okay, so now he's saying on this.
Shulchan Aruch exists without his comments?
I don't think
no.
You can find one.
Oh.
I mean, it did at some point, yeah, for a little while maybe. But the two, like I said, they're contemporaries of one another. And the Shulchan Aruch was accepted. And then when the Rama had this idea, then everyone was happy. I don't know. I'm not a world traveler.
So
Beryl Wine would know.
We're going to try, as you know, far be it for me to try to read it, but assuming I could.
You're not too far away.
This is what I would pick up.
Yes. Okay.
Because it's the latest, or
yeah. So you would have a hard time finding a Shulchan Aruch without a Rama. You'd have to go. I mean, if you go to Ethiopia, you know, they have bookstores, or Yemen, or some other, you know, Arabic land. Maybe I don't know if you could get to Iraq or Iran anymore. But you know, if you get to some places that they
are they translated into English as well?
Yes. Yeah. You can get this in English. Okay. So. Not all. Remember the tour. There's four Turim. There's four sections. We talked about it last time, right? The Or Chaim, the first one, you can get full in English, all of it, and all kinds of explanation. No one's done a lot of translation of the other three sections, so I don't know if you can get that in English.
So this exists as a large volume of books. But
yes.
This is last week we talked about that. Only the books that we would look at would be, or the ones printed would be the ones that pertain to what we can use, what we could do now.
That's all the Shulchan Aruch
is
like. Right. That's all the Shulchan Aruch is that. Okay. So it doesn't. There's no temple law like that.
Right.
Okay.
No other religion has as many books.
Oh, that's for sure not. That's what we call the people of the book.
I was just thinking that you must have the highest percentage of people. Wearing glasses of any group.
And rooted all the way back to the beginning.
There was no Dark Ages in Judaism. That's something that's important to know. There was never a period of time where anyone tried to keep us ignorant.
So once again, I'm sorry. The Shulchan Aruch is arranged kind of like the Baal HaTorim into Chosh and Mishpat and just the way the other...
Right. Okay. Same. He kept the exact same format.
Got it.
Okay? It looks the same, in fact. Right, and you have to be careful when you pick it up. Now, you'll see right away from the commentators that they're different. Okay, if you pick up a Torah, you'll see, you'll read up here, and there are different commentators. The Beis Yosef will be here. There's no Beis Yosef. He's right in here. He's a Shulchan Aruch, right? So he's silly to have Beis Yosef commentary on himself, you know. That'd be kind of silly. So there's other commentaries on that. So that's it for, this is the segue between Rishonim and Achronim. And we're not going to go through all the Achronim in the kind of detail, because they come in all kinds of flavors. There's all kinds of different type of Achronim. There's commentaries like this. So, for example, I'm not going to mention them by name because there's so many. But, you know, all of these are Achronim. Here, this is one, there's another one, here's another one. These are all stuff. You go to Halacha Shir, you'll hear all of them cited. Okay? They're all cited, right? Go to Rabbi Sauer Shir, you know, he's like, they'll go from here to here to here to here and so on and so forth. So those are all one type of Achron. It's a commentary on an existing book. Then there are what's called Tshuvas, Shilas and Tshuvas, right? So the Rav of a city would get questions, or if he's a very big Rav, people know him, or there's a Rav of a country, or people send him letters from other countries even. So he or his students might write a book. If they're, like, sometimes what happens oftentimes is after the person passes on, then to sing his praises, his Talmidim or his family will write a book with the collections of Shilas and Tshuvas. Shila is a question, Tshuva is a response. So sometimes you'll see it referred to as the responses of so-and-so. That's an Achron, okay? So that's it. So those are questions and answers. And the answers, you know, it's like, it's not simple questions. It's not like the questions that we would ask of our Rav, you know, if I dropped a piece of meat into my milk, if I dropped some milk into my, you know, is this still kosher? It's not that kind of question. These are more thought-provoking questions that one would have to actually sit and think and work his way through. And the answer would involve going through many sources, this source, another source, perhaps a third source, going back to the Gemara and writing it all out and saying, this is why I believe that the answer is like this. Okay? And that gets recorded, and that's in a book, and that's an Achron. That's another further commentary. So, for example, you'll hear, we'll get to Chassam Sofer later, the great Hungarian master of the middle 19th century, early 19th century. So we'll get to him a little later on. But he's most famous for Shilas and Tshuvas Chassam Sofer. You know, that's he wrote books, many, many volumes.
What was his name?
The Chassam Sofer. We'll get to him in a moment.
From Pressburg?
Yeah, very good.
I saw his keva.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. In Pressburg, right? That's still it, right? Yeah. It's a whole interesting. I just read his great-grandsons, their whole series of generations there. His grandson is Yortzad's coming up, the Shevet Sofer. And he went to Frankfurt late in his life, and he died in Frankfurt. Now, Frankfurt was the city that Chassam Sofer was born in. And he actually became fairly well known in Frankfurt. He wasn't famous; he wasn't world famous until he went to Pressburg. So they wanted to bury him in Frankfurt, the grandson of Chassam Sofer. And he was great on his own. He was not; he was no lightweight at all. And the people of Pressburg had no way. So there was like a big battle over where the body should be. It really, a remarkable story. And they eventually won Pressburg because they had a whole kever set for him, ready to go. His father, the grandson, and so on and so forth. Fascinating story, but one of the many little stories. So there's many, many different types of commentaries and super commentaries and so on and so forth. So we're not going to go into detail. What I wanted to do is explain a little bit of history so you understand some of the realities of today with regards to halacha. Okay, we've gone through now about until through the 16th century. The biggest split in halacha within mainstream Judaism, within mainstream halachic Judaism, is between the Vilna Gaon, the Gra, and Hasidus. That's the biggest split. And in fact, at one point, for about two generations, there was a threat to totally split into two streams. This is before Reform. Mm-hmm. Before all that, okay? But thankfully, thank God, that was patched up and everything, and we all live happily ever after, so to speak, okay? What was the basis for it? The big difference between the two initially was halacha, was halachic, and the emphasis within halachic. What constitutes being strict? What constitutes doing the right thing, doing, you know, walking a straight line? And there was a big split on what that meant. So before we get to that, so you have to understand, it's very important, as Beryl Wine would say, to understand world history to understand Jewish history, number one. And number two, when you see issues like this, you got to understand Jewish history. So one of the things that always kept Jews going through good times and bad times, especially bad times, is the knowledge that Mashiach is on his way. That's like a sense of Jewish optimism. Somewhere in there, we always knew he's coming. We know it's been a long time, and now we know it even more than they did 400 years ago. But we know deep in our hearts that this is something that's going to happen. And our kids get it regularly. They know, you don't have to be the Bavitcher Chassid to wave the flag of Mashiach. It's, but it's still, it's part and parcel of knowing. Rambam says it's one of our 13 principles, right? So we have to know that it's coming.
But usually it seems the Chabad.
Yeah, they made it famous.
Outspoken about it.
That's true. This is true. Okay? So what happened was, in the years 1648 and 1649, there was a person by the name of Bogdan Khmelnytsky. It's hard to say and hard to spell, Khmelnytsky, who led a group of peasants and Cossacks, Kazakhstan, Cossacks, right, in the Ukraine in an effort to protest, and those protests were not like today's protests, these are violent protests, for a reasonable, their motive was reasonable, and that is landlords back then, fiefdoms, the period of fiefdoms, where people had no rights whatsoever and were entirely at the mercy of the local governor, who charged whatever rate they wanted. There was no rate control. if he had a bad year, he would just quadruple the rate, and he really didn't care if didn't make it. He'd just take things from you. And there was no doubt he was the government, So there was a major revolt against this. And as often happens when these major revolts happen, the Jews got it amongst the worst. It's estimated that about 300,000 Jews died out of about 1 to 1.1 million total. So it was,
A pogrom, basically. Right?
It was a pogrom against all landlords, but the Jews were the middlemen. That's all. Remember, as Jews were very limited as to what they could do, There was unions. Not unions, what do they call
Guilds?
Themselves? Guilds, thank you. Guilds of any group, and they said, no Jews. They wanted to keep competition out, right? So one of the few things they could do was handle with money, and being middleman is a perfect money position. I'll pay you, you pay me, I'll make sure the money is obtained. So they were stuck in the middle. So when people are revolting, the middleman gets it sometimes, even though oftentimes had no choice. The boss says, triple the rate. The Jew says, I got to triple the rate, he's got to come up with it, right? Okay, so that was one part. There was a fellow by the name of Shabtai Tzvi, who you've heard of. Mm-hmm. He was born in Turkey in 1626. So by 1648, which is what the year we're talking about, he's 22 years old, and he had already had a following as a Kabbalist. He was very big in Torah. He was a big Talmud Chacham, in the sense that he knew a lot of Torah, but he was insincere. The news of the massacres of the Ukraine came down. Even without internet, people heard about this thing. And the view was this was the birth pains of Messiah. Okay? That's how it works together. And he had a dream that he was Messiah. And he told people, and some people thought, he's a Kabbalist, he's a Talmud Chacham, we know the Messiah's got to be coming now after this. He must be right. Wow! And he started having quite a following. And it's not just simpletons. There were rabbis, not the leading rabbis, but many municipal rabbis, heads, who went for this. But there were antagonism to him, and ultimately this whole thing would have just faded out if not for an event in his life. In 1663, so now he's 37 or so, right? So now he goes to Gaza. He goes on a boat to Gaza from Turkey, right? So it's not that far. And he gets there, and he's like trying to spread the message. And he runs into this guy named Nathan Nossen. And Nathan, as Beryl Wine said it very, very well, he said Nathan was to Shabtai Tzvi what Paul was to Christianity. You can argue that Christianity would have never, ever taken off if not for Paul. Paul was the great marketing expert of Christianity. If you study anything about early Christianity, he changed it enough to make it a great appeal. He's the one that said you don't have to do you don't have to do mitzvahs anymore. Before that, they said, you know, it's a derivative of Judaism, yeah, but everything plus believe in Yashka, right? He said, he died for your sins, and then, you know, it's like, which nut is the, kind of, anyway, you know, he changed the rules enough that made it palatable to, for there were pagans then, there, you know, or non-believers to believe. So without Nathan, Shabtai Tzvi would have been absolutely nothing. He would have been, would have died right about then. He wouldn't have died physically. He would have, the whole movement would have died. He was his number one campaign manager. Okay, he went out of his way. This guy is for real. You got to believe him. And he would introduce him to a city and so on and so forth. And then this really then caught on. And for the next 3 years, he was major big time. The Rabbi Wein says that you can in Amsterdam was one of the big ports. We're talking American U.S. history, which we all learned, I guess, right? So in the 1660s, there were, you know, Amsterdam, New Amsterdam was after Amsterdam, and New York was called New Amsterdam, right? So that was New York. So Amsterdam was one of the big ports, and, you know, it was closed down because the Jews sold their houses so they can have enough money to come to, and they rented boats so they can come to Jerusalem because the Messiah was coming. It was just, it was stunning. And this is written there. Actually, there's records of this sort of stuff.
Jews were leaving New Amsterdam to go...
Not New Amsterdam. Amsterdam.
Oh, Amsterdam.
Europe.
Okay.
This, I don't know if this... There weren't very many Jews in the New World. But in Europe, this was like... This was big. This was really big. And not everybody went for this. There are recorded opinions, and you hear... You see their writings. This is all crazy. This is Shekhar. People are nuts. You know, they're gone off their rocker. You know, and he... So in 1666, he decided he's going to abolish Tisha B'Av and the 17th of Tammuz, because after all, the temple is going to be rebuilt this year, so why mourn for its loss? And things were so big that by, I don't know, before Rosh Hashanah, so the Sultan decided he had enough. It was too much of a sideshow going on. So he asked him to come in. You know, and when the Sultan asks, the answer is yes. So he goes in and he says, enough's enough. You convert to Islam or we're going to kill you. So he converted to Islam. So the show was pretty much over. The depression that hit the Jewish people on the heels of 1648 Khmelnytsky massacre, and this was overwhelming, absolutely overwhelming. And that's why I wanted to bring in Beryl White, because he really brings in the psychological part too, which you have to understand. I mean, it's hard to empathize, I think, with what must have gone on. You know, you think this is it. This is like the Messiah's finally come, and not only has he not come, but we were out of our minds. What were we thinking? There were, just as an aside, I'm not going to get into it in any detail, but there was still a strange following of Shabbosism that went on for maybe 50 to 100 years, and there were some very strange phenomena that went on, which we're not going to get into because that's off of what we want to discuss. As a result of this whole problem, this double whammy of a massacre, the scope of which, as far as a percent is concerned, was comparable to the Holocaust, it was about a third of civilized Jewry, number one. Number two, the false Messiah. And there were other false messiahs. He wasn't the only one, but he was the one that made the biggest splash. It was threefold. That was relevant to us. There was always a question of the role of public study of Kabbalah. Not Yosef Karo, because he wasn't an active Kabbalist. He knew Kabbalah, but you don't see anywhere in here, for example, anything about Kabbalah or the opinions of Kabbalah. But people who lived in Sfat with him were very big Kabbalists. The Ari lived about the same time, the Ari Zal, right? And his Moshe Kardavero. So they were very, very big Kabbalists. And after Moshe Kardavero, there was a big disagreement on whether it should go public or not. Kabbalah was always meant for not the masses. It was meant for small numbers of people who were already, you know, very well versed in Talmud. And over the next, that we're talking about 1580s, 1590s, early 1600s, it became more widespread. So the fact that Shabbosai Tzvi was a Kabbalist So it's like people try to put the genie back in the bottle now. Wait, we made a mistake. This is obvious. Look, because of his Kabbalah knowledge, we went for it. We got to put it back where it belonged. So that was one reality. Okay, it was like more of like almost like a visceral distaste of public Kabbalah teaching. Nothing wrong with Kabbalah, okay? But to teach it publicly, it reminds us of Shabtai Tzvi, and this is what it led to, so let's not even go there. Right, that kind of thing. Visceral. Okay, number two is Shabtai Tzvi is the grandfather of reform. Because what was he? He was a representation that we're not willing to wait for the world and natural forces to come to us. We're going to make it happen. And that's if the early reformers, if you listen to what they said, is there, yes, there's the Messiah, but the Messiah is us. We're going to bring the redemption. And we're going to change things. They believe in God. The early reformers are very much into God believers, but they, you know, they're not willing to sit back and wait until God brings the Messiah. We're going to bring the Messiah. You know, we are the national movement of Jews, and the world together will bring enlightenment and Messiah. The Messiah is a reality. It's not a person. Okay? And number three is there was, and this is the worst, there was a palpable loss of erosion of faith in the Rabbanus and leadership because he was a leader, right? So, and that was a big, that was a huge problem because until then, really, there was, you know, the leader was the leader, and I believe the leader whatever he says, the Marav of my city, the rabbi of my shul, whatever, you know, whoever is my rabbinical authority. He says jump, I say how high, you know, and that's like, that's where I go. And this was the first real scratch at that. So those are the major, major results of Shabtai Tzvi. So that was all then. Comes to this picture, the Baal Shem Tov. Baal Shem Tov was a real person, not even though you hear pretty amazing stories about him. He himself was very real, and I think by any standard, a Talmud Chacham, and a very sincere person, and a very loving person. He was born in 1700, so now I understand how this whole, why the history is clearly important. He came at the very heels of this, okay? And he lived for 60 years, so he takes us into the 18th century, but at the heels of this tragic half century. I won't tell you half any of the stories, but he, because now the stories are not for this, but he went into the forest and he decided that he was told this is his vision. He wanted to bring Jews to the common man. Why? Because really, as we've tried to cover today and especially last week, we mentioned a lot about how it was, you know, what were all these abridged Gemara is all about, the Rif. Remember we said the Rif was the one in the back who wrote the Gemara, but he took out all the other sections, all the arguments and all the stories, and he just wanted to give you an abridged mm-hmm. version. The Rosh did something very similar. The Rambam and the Tur wrote organized, organized and concise halacha by halacha by halacha, because they figure that the average person just can't keep up with all this, and how does someone even find halacha? Doesn't know what to do. So there is a loss of scholarship, but yet it's the scholars who are going to be, you know, the ones that are getting any education. So you have a two-tier Judaism, the very small minority of scholars, right, and certainly only men. You know, at that time, there were no women scholars unless they happened to be by their fathers. You know, their parents teach them. There was no school for women. We're talking, again, early 1700s now. And then there were the masses, the huge numbers of everybody else, who, you know, when they're 13, they go become, you know, a shoemaker or something else, whatever they're allowed to do. They're allowed to have own property or have property, you know, agriculture. If not, they do something like milkman, delivery, water boy, whatever else they could do. They're, you know, many, many, many peasants. So, and there was no middle class, right? So this is like most people. But what do those people do as far as religious or spiritual nourishment? What do they do? They learn from their fathers, okay, you don't, you know, you put on your right shoe before you left, put on your left shoe, you say Kriya Shema this time, you say, and you look at the board, what time you're supposed to say, so you say the basics, but by scholarship, nothing, zero. You know, they went to cheder for a couple, two, three, you know, until they're 12 or 13, and that's it, right? So, what do they do? How do they, like, relate to the Almighty? Other than through education, there was no other way. So comes the Baal Shem Tov and he says, you know, we got it all wrong. Because really, the ultimate is to have a relationship with the Almighty. And it's an emotional relationship. You got to know that God cares about you. And that was missing. As obvious as that sounds. And especially this is applicable in tefillah. Right? Because tefillah is where davening, prayer, is especially where we relate to the Almighty, because we're talking to Him. Right? So, among the many halachic changes that we saw within the first two generations of Chassidus is the emphasis on time went away. Because we know, you know, the Gemara says it, the Shulchan Aruch codifies it, that that Kriya Shema has to be said in the first fourth of the day, and davening has to be in the first third of the day. And that's what it says. So first third of the day, so 3 hours, first 3 hours, and first 4 hours, halachic hours, and we're not getting into details. So from sunrise, approximately, add 3 hours, approximately, and that's when you say Kriya Shema, right? About 4 hours, and that's when you say Shemoneh Esrei. So if you're going to say that the essence of the of our functions as Jews is to relate to the Almighty as our Father in heaven, and the way to do that is through prayer, why rush to that? I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all. It's like, hurry up, and you're tired, and you have to, you know, you got to quickly pray, and, you know, focus. This is it. This is the highlight of your day. Right? So there's de-emphasis of time. That's number one. So additionally, at times, an emotional commitment could make up for lack of following the technicalities. Okay. And that's, of course, in the sense of ignorance, not in the sense of intentional lack of following technicalities. That was their major emphasis. That was the Baal Shem Tov. I'm not going to go through all the generations of Chassidus, or even any for that matter. The Misnagdim, Misnagid means against or opposed. And it was actually a name coined by the Chassidim as a negative name. I mean, you're opposed to us, kind of thing, right? So I think they wore it as a badge of honor nonetheless. But the Misnagdim were led by the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon was an absolute genius by anybody's breadth and stretch of imagination. Never slept. He slept a total of, you know, 2 hours a day, but didn't sleep. He took cat naps of 30 minutes at a time. And was born in 1720, died at the end of the century. So he was younger than the Baal Shem Tov by 20 years. The Baal Shem Tov's major Talmud, the Maggid of Mezrich, was approximate contemporary of the Vilna Gaon. And, you know, because of his length of times of years, so the third generation also were very, very, very familiar with him. He was concerned that the Hasidim were treading on dangerous waters. In other words, everything the Baal Shem Tov said and what he did and how he practiced was fine. However, this emphasis and major discussion of where they're putting things was dangerous, because if there's a lack of appreciation for the technicalities of halacha, then all that we talked about, the whole science of halacha, is gone. Right? If you're not careful about the technicalities of how you build a rocket, then the thing that just took off the other night would never have taken off. It's all nice that you love it and it's a beautiful thing and it's nice and it's right, you know, but that's great, but if you don't do it right, it's not going to work. So he was quite concerned. And I guess you can say a policy statement of the Misnagdim was written by his main disciple. The main disciple of the Vilna Gaon was Rav Chaim Volozhin, or Volozhiner. But wasn't his last name. He didn't have one. I'm sure he had a last name.
Volozhin
was the place. It was the Volozhin Yeshiva, right? It was where he built the first modern yeshiva. We know yeshiva the way we know what yeshiva is, anyway. And Rav Chaim was the major pupil and disciple of the Vilna Gaon. And he wrote a book, which is a very important book, called the Nefesh HaChaim, okay, which really basically talks about what happens when you do a mitzvah. What happens to the soul, how it improves, how it reacts, and what happens if you do it correctly, if you do it half-heartedly, and what if you do it a little bit right, or, you know, it's like a science book.
Is that translated into the living heart?
No, well, I don't know. Well, Chaim was on his name. The Nefesh HaChaim but it's the soul of the living, or a living, and yeah, it could be the soul of the life, the soul of life, perhaps. Yeah, that's an interesting point. I never thought of, yeah. I don't think I've ever seen it in English. Have you seen it in English? I have it in Hebrew, if you're interested. Not easy reading. So you need a chavrus for it. you need someone to help you. I can't learn it my own. I tell you that now. But basically, what it says, like, what goes on in heaven when you do a mitzvah, what does not? And, you know, if you do it correctly. So the claim that they're making is a less meaningful prayer on time will do more for your soul than a very meaningful prayer done but not on time. And that's the essence of the pivotal differences of machlokas. Right? What's more important? Doing the mitzvah on time when it's called for to do it on time? And we're not talking about seconds. We're talking about you have a 3-hour window here. Mm-hmm. Or you do the mitzvah with far more fervor and excitement and enthusiasm, but it's not when it's supposed to be. It's like, to give a really wild example, if you hear and you have all the kavanas of a shofar, and mentally it's beautifully done, it's perfectly, but it's done on the wrong day. So obviously they haven't fulfilled, they have done nothing for a mitzvah. You know, that means it counts for zero. Bah, but I felt great about it. It doesn't matter. So I'm arguing, obviously, the mitzvah is not good size. I feel bad about this. But that's the essence of the discussion. Mm. You feel the difference?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, over the next two generations, really, they kind of kissed and made up a little bit, in a little bit. the way Beryl Wine explains it, the misnagdim became a little more Hasidic, and the Hasidim became a little bit more misnagdim. And it didn't have, the first two generations were wildly apart. But at the third, fourth generation, then there's far more commonality. But you still see this difference, and that's one of the bases of the difference in halacha. So there's a difference in regards to chumrah. Chumrah means stringency. Right? The Hasidim developed a system called Yiras Shemayim, because they basically understand that if you're talking about relating and developing a relationship with God, if something doesn't sound right, then just stay away from it. If it doesn't feel Jewish, don't even go there. To the Hasidim, many of the practices of the Misnagdim, the active daily practices, were non-Jewish. I mean, they looked at Misnagdim as almost non, their activity was non-Jewish, to this very day. I'll give a couple of examples in a moment, but I want to bring in some other thoughts, okay? The Misnagdim, if he knows his Gemara and his Rishonim, he's fine. He's doing fine. He's not going to slip up. But among the ignorant peasantry, all he has is an emotional attachment, and he's kind of messed up. He has nothing. He's got no intellectual ability to connect with the learning. He has no emotional connection. He's kind of stuck. So the Hasidim grew in popularity and in numbers like wildfire. You know, within a few generations, most of Poland became Hasidic. You know, unfortunately, when the Holocaust hit, and Poland was just devastated. We lost millions of Jews in Poland alone. Then it was much of that was Hasidic, mm-hmm. right? And it was devastating to Hasidim. I mean, not the leaders, in fact, were many of the leaders were killed, along with the common man. So the academics of Hasidim then became implanted in the third generation. That's when very famous and a very important person in halacha came around. His name was Shneur Zalman from Liadi. Liadi, he was the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. Because he moved to Lubavitch at the end of his life. And his followers, you know, moved with them, and they stayed there. Okay, Lubavitch is a city near Chernobyl. He himself wrote the Shulchan Aruch Harav. You'll see it sometimes, it's just the Shulchan Aruch. It's very confusing, but it's not. It's not Shulchan, it's Shulchan Aruch. I didn't say Shulchan Aruch Harav in his book. We don't have it in the library. I looked last week. It is not a safer halacha lemaisa for non-Hasidim, but for students of halacha, it is a very important body of work to learn and to study, because he brings thoughts and insights that other people just don't. Rabbi Bess, for example, who is by any stretch of the imagination not a Hasid, okay, at all. He's a misnagid, Ashkenaz from Germany, from the get-go. So he often quotes the Shulchan Aruch Harav, often, to bring understanding of how to understand halacha. So that tells you. That tells you a number of things. It tells you that people have come together. There's a general respect for the academics. It tells you the greatness of the Shulchan Aruch Harav. That leadership and studiousness has come through in philosophy for Lubavitch, has not come through in a way of... no one has come close to him. His seventh, I think the last Lubavitcher Rebbe was the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe. But no one has come close to him in their publishing and in their academics. So they may have been as Talmid Chachamim, but nothing like them.
He was the first one.
He was something special, yeah. So, and there were others as well, but he certainly was a light. Other Hasidim used the Shulchan Aruch Harav as a standard text for halacha. Not just Lubavitch. Okay, so in both camps, the local rabbi was kind of like the final word. And that's going to be important, we find, the next phase, because that leads us to what's called the Haskalah, or the Enlightenment. This was about the early 1800s, and it peaked about the 1840s. Now, what happened here also requires some historical note. Germany was the first country in Europe where Jews received rights. Okay, absolutely, I mean, like, rights of anybody. This is the reality. Germany was the leader in human rights. That's why, by the way, it's so shocking. And people couldn't believe that Germany was the birth of Nazism.
You never predict anything, that's what it proves.
But people just were stunned beyond, how could this possibly be? They said, you know, Germany was the highlight of developed cultural life, right? And among them, in many ways, culture as Beethoven, you know, okay, but also culture as far as human rights is concerned. The leader here, it was the birthplace of Protestant Reformation as a movement against Catholicism, against the structure of Catholicism. It was the birthplace that led to secular humanism as a movement. One of the leaders that made this very impressive and important is Frederick the Great, the king, if you remember world history or European history, you had that. So he was a major figure. He was in the 18th century. And he was a believer in this humanism, what's called the benevolent despot. I remember that from my world history expression,
yeah,
right? He was a friend of Voltaire. He actually corresponded with Voltaire, who's a philosopher in France, but they went back and forth in there. And he decided he was going to test liberalism. The way Beryl Wine describes it, and I don't know if this is entirely true, or he was kind of like making a little bit of a cute analysis of this all, but he says that this was like, he didn't know how far he could take this, but he figured if he tried it with the Jews and it failed, then no problem, just put the Jews back in the ghettos and no one would argue, you know? So I'm not sure if that's exactly true or not, but it does make a little bit of sense. He says, in other words, give them all rights, whatever rights they want to do. Do whatever you want, go into business you want. We assume these rights are inalienable, as this says in the Constitution, right? You know? But this was, you know, earth-shaking in Europe, even though it happened at about the same time as the Constitutional Convention here in Philadelphia. So Frederick the Great allowed Jews to go to college. They allowed Jews to go to any whatever job and professions they wanted. Among the early people who took advantage of this was Moses Mendelssohn. So you remember that name, perhaps? Moses Mendelssohn was a Talmud Chacham of great note. History is not painting a pretty picture of him, but at the time he was, we know in a number of different ways, he certainly kept to Torah and mitzvahs. He went to university, he got doctorate degrees, and then he became a confidant of the king's. And he wrote in his memoirs, you know, I couldn't see the king today because otherwise I'd be late for mincha. You know, that means davening. Well, I wouldn't do that. I would daven b'yechidus and go see the king, right? So Moses Mendelssohn was on a far greater level, you know, than me. But he would wait because the minion that meets at this time, I'm sorry, I can't meet with you, the minion, you know, so that's a madriga. And yet, the way Beryl Wine explains it is, I've used this in other explaining other things as well, that sometimes the problem with very gifted geniuses is that they assume the rest of the world thinks like they do, or can do what they do. That's often not the case. And the proof of the pudding is that I think all of his sons married out, something like that. It was terrible. I mean, that whole family's gone, but it went, like within one or two generations, it was gone. Not through death, but through, you know, outside assimilation, major assimilation. You know, the genie gets out of the bottle, everything smells good. He himself was a Torah Jew, but he gets painted with broad strokes of black paint because his descendants didn't do well at all. And his followers didn't do well at all. You know, people who read his stuff and read his it in itself was noble. We're not allowed to read it because of what happened to him. And like, it's like, oh, look what happened. He obviously didn't do a good job. So I don't urge you to go out and buy your next, you know, Moses Mendelssohn book. But that happened is what I was saying is that happened as a direct result of Frederick the Great.
I'm sorry. You know, I think you're assuming that I know more about Moses Mendelssohn than I do. I don't. What's the bottom? What did he do? What's he responsible for? What you're saying?
No, he himself was a Torah observing Jew to his death, but he wrote things that you can serve. He wrote things that would not even strike us as bad. He'd say, you know, the non-Jews are our friends, and you can discuss them, and you know, things like we do all the time. Right, we are able to do it. He wrote about it, and it was at the time very antithetical to what most of European Jews would hold to be true. And people would politely disagree with him and say, you shouldn't do that. He translated the Bible into German, which had never been done before. Never been done before. We think, so what, Art Scrolls translates into English, so what's the problem? Right? So, you know, he did things that, for that time, perhaps it was time-related, and it led, you can see it in his own children, and you can see, and he wasn't a rabbi in the sense that he had a following or a shul or anything like that, but people who, you know, kind of like gravitated towards him also left the derech. So everybody who went near him went off the derech.
So that eliminates my next question. He was not a posek, and this was not in terms of responsa.
Correct. No, there was no responsa. He was not a posek. He did not write responsa at all.
So this is just philosophical stuff that he put out for the common Jew to read?
Right. Which I guess if you had a level of commitment as strong as his, and a mind as strong as his, you could live with. Uh-huh. But missing either one of those two ingredients, you're off. And that's what happened. And that's what happened to many people because of this Frederick the Great experiment. And reform was quick to follow in the 1840s. The Orthodox response, where are we? Oh, right, this is important to know. The danger, remember, we're living in a time where most Jews were living in shtiblach, right? A shtibl, we don't have such things here, okay? Here, Jews live in generally metropolitan areas with occasionally, you know, suburbs, right? You have, you know, a couple of major neighborhoods in L.A., and then a few scattered, talking about observant Jews, right? Some in Venice, some in, you know, Agora, you know, a couple, but they're centered around the Los Angeles metropolitan. Mm-hmm. You know, there's Detroit, and there's one suburb there. I think there's Chicago, and there's Skokie, there's New York, and then there's a whole bunch of suburbs there, mm-hmm. right? And it's like you have Miami, and you have Boca Raton. So again, it's always like the metropolitan area, and then maybe a couple scattered there.
Satellite areas,
but you won't see any in like in the middle of, you know, eastern Washington State. You know, there's none. There's no shul there, right? Not even Chabad. So there, in Europe, that was not the case. In Europe, you go, you know, several dozen miles in your middle of nowhere, and then there's a little town, like not even a town. It's a
village.
It's hardly a village. It's like, you know, you got a post office, you got a village store, and you got about, you know, 20 houses, and that's it. That's it. You have to walk somewhere, take a carriage somewhere to get the only caravan. And, you know, this is before even trains came in, right? So you stayed there the whole time. And there was many of these, many, many of these. And every one of these had its rabbi. Right? So you have a rabbi, and let's assume for the time being he's sincere. And everyone, you know, there are some who are great. Most are not great. Most will go to larger areas because they'll get larger communities. And
more
everyone,
money.
Pardon me?
More money.
That's part of it, but really let's try to be a little give a little credit. Everyone wants to affect as many people positively as you can, right? If it's not just an honor, but to know that you're using your abilities to help God in this world, if you're given a lot of abilities and people keep telling you, you want to affect not tens, but hundreds or thousands, right? Directly. And then there's the letters and the things you publish and so on. Okay. So in every community, you have one leader, and then you have a bunch of people who really know much less, whether it's Hasidim or Nisnagdim, right? So what would happen if the rabbi goes a little bit off? A little, not off the derech altogether, and starts answering questions, but it's not exactly authentic. Because actually, if you're arguing with an achron, you're allowed to argue with an achron. Mm-hmm. You know, you can say, if Joseph Karo himself, if you say, that's what the Ramah was doing, right? The Ramah was arguing with Joseph Karo, and he brought the Ashkenazic opinion. He's allowed to do that because Karo was an achron, right? And similarly, the Aruch HaShulchan, which we'll get into, I'm not going to get into anyway, he was like the late 19th century. So, you know, he had differences of opinion with than the Chafetz Chaim, with the Mishneh Berurah, which is another sefer. You see that there are allowances for differences of opinion. So it's fine if you're a lumden, if you're a learner, and you sit in the Beis Medrash and you say, well, show me why you think this way. But if you're in a small village in Kahupaville, then somewhere in Europe, you're not going to know. You're just not going to know. So if if he tells you the Rosh said this and the Rambam said this, it's good enough for me. It's like I learned that in Cheder. I remember the Rosh and the Rambam. You know, that's fine. So that sounds pretty good to me. If he starts making up his own stuff that's based, I found this in the Rambam and I found this. Sounds good to me. So you're going to have some people going a little bit off, and that's exactly what started happening. The man on the street is not going to know when your Rav is arguing with an Achron or arguing with a Rishon or arguing with a Gemara for that matter, which you have no right doing. You can't go arguing with the Gemara. So unfortunately, what started happening in Europe was a lot of rabbis were taking their congregants for a ride. And the worst part of Haskalah was that most people who fell prey to it were defenseless. They didn't have the academic backing to be able to say, I don't think you can do that, Rabbi. Mm-hmm. Okay, and by the way, that is why today there is such an emphasis on learning. We don't want that to ever happen again. If we can't have the insularity of the shtetlach, which is gone, you can't have that anymore. Not only because we don't have little tiny villages, but communications being what it is, there's just no way. And transportation, and people coming in and out, and it's just no way. But if you can't have that, at least have the academics to know when someone says something outlandish or not. They didn't know. And whole communities went off the derech as a result of that. So they couldn't fight against it. And this, unfortunately, this may sound familiar, but this is really what goes on in much of the non-Orthodox world today. I mean, this is very temporally relevant. I think that after the conservative movement's most recent pronouncements, but you see that in Reform. You know, Reform, at least now it's like they make no effort to say they're halachic, but at least before when they're saying they were, the congregants have no backing, no recognition of why this is right, this is wrong. Now it's like, well, if he says so, that's fine. This is what Judaism means to me. Yeah? So you have whole congregations of hundreds of people, really academically, and I won't say intellectually because they're bright people, but they don't have the academic background to be able to put up a fight, to debate. They can't debate. How do you debate that? Even if they wanted to debate it, they couldn't debate. What's the sources for it? Where do you start the debate? It's the sad part. So how does one deal with Haskalah? So we see, and I think we'll kind of like finish with this, but there were three or four major ways to fight it. As far as Hasidus is concerned, there's no problem. You just listen to your Rebbe, whatever the Rebbe said. The Rebbes themselves, and this is the genius of Hasidus, there wasn't just a one Rav of the town. The Rav of the town was just an emissary of the Rebbe. The Rebbe happened to live there. So if I can't live with the Rebbe, which I really, really want to do, then I'll go visit him whenever chance I get. And this my leader here is his emissary. Mm-hmm. You know, I trust him to go back and forth and check everything else with the Rebbe. The Rebbes were always sincere. There was never a problem with the Rebbes. Most of them were Talmid Chachamim. So it was never a problem with Hasidim. They never felt, they were never threatened by Haskalah. Germany and France fell to pieces. Germany, I think, within one or two generations, was 90% reformed. It was just it went from all to none. The altar of Nevardik, Rabbi Yosef Yozel Horowitz. He lived in the late part of the 19th century, the very early 20th century. He created yeshivas, more than 50 of them. He had a whole branch of Nevardik. There was a Nevardik yeshiva, but there was so many other Nevardik yeshivas. It was like the Nevardik yeshiva of here, of here, of here, of here, of here. And his idea was to get kids, any bright kids, if you had like any inkling of intelligence, will bring you to the yeshiva. They actually kidnapped kids. They would have yeshiva bachers go on trains and go up and down looking for Jewish-looking kids, get into conversations with them and say, on the course of the train, listen, what you really want to do is learn with us, because this is really, you're a smart kid. This is what you really... And by the time, the next city came along, he was convinced. He wasn't really kidnapped. He didn't go against his wishes. Certainly went against his parents' wishes. His parents thought he was going to university, but he actually went up to Nevardik Yeshiva. So that's one of the things they would do. They would just like take kids and put them in yeshiva. That was the goal.
Horowitz. Aha.
Now you know where it comes from. I don't think it came from him, but that certainly sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sounds awfully familiar, that approach.
Yeah. In other words, he understood that if you have the intellectuals, and you then all we need to do is feed you the academics, then you understand with your bright mind, given the material, the Torah speaks for itself. Yeah, it's just we feel bad for you. You never had a chance to learn this stuff. Okay, and these are kids. We're not talking. These are like 14 to 15 year old kids. They weren't talking about adults. They weren't going off to work. Hirsch, in entirely 19th century. So he had another idea, centralize it. The problem was Shtiblach, right? You had a little here, and all the Rav didn't know what to do with 50 people. So centralized Judaism. So he built a huge kehil in Frankfurt on Main, how do you pronounce it? Frankfurt. We say Frankfurt now, but it's Frankfurt on Main, and in Germany. And it became a huge metropolitan area. This is after them. We said the Chassam Sofer, but this is after him, actually. We have a misidea about him because he started with a very small Jewish world, and by the time the end of his life, Frankfurt was a huge Jewish. He wasn't the car of a lot of people, but people moved to Frankfurt. People are oftentimes confused with what he was. He was very successful at what he did, but he wasn't the car of. He also, if you read his commentary, it reads very well to us today. He took on reform head on. And he said, you're going to argue details with us? You've got to be crazy, And he argued every single point in his commentary to the Torah, where on the line, wherever it was relevant. And you'll see it. It's very fitting. Many places, it's definitely worth reading. Some of those quote-unquote enlightened people say this, to this we say, and he argues from this. And he goes on rather strong word diatribes against it, because he was fighting these people. He didn't want his kehila affected by this this problem. Finally, the Chassam Sofer. I told you we talk about him. Fascinating man and a brilliant man. He was born in 1762 and he lived into the 19th century. He was born in Frankfurt before Hirsch, and then he moved around to several places, but he eventually became Rav of Pressburg. Which is now Bratislava.
Right.
So, is it Czechoslovakia now or is it Hungary now?
It's Bratislava.
Which is in which country now?
It's
Remember?
It's outside of
Czech Republic? Czech Republic? I don't remember. Where is it? It's Bratislava. It's in this country of Bratislava, which is the other part
so.
Of the Czechs. Okay.
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. He had a different approach. And this is going to explain other things to you. Okay? Let me just look at my notes because I have to say this well. Okay. Remember the prerequisites of deciding halacha. We talked about this several classes ago. One, you have to know the material. You have to know Gemara and Rishonim. And two, you have to be sincere. Right? Those are the two requirements of psak halacha. You have to know what you're passing on and the basics of the psak. And two, you have to approach it objectively. You got to take yourself out of it. You got to like not go into it thinking you know the answer already, as opposed to the old trick of getting a bullseye every time, right? You take swing. There's the arrow, then you paint bullseye around it. Right, I know what the answer is going to be, and now I got to figure out how to make it the answer, right? That's not how we approach halacha. We approach halacha as I have no pretense to knowing what the answer is going to be. I want to find out what it is from the Torah. That's being totally objective. And sincere. That's okay. So Haskalah's approach is, let alone Rishonim, but even Gemara, nothing was sacred. Okay, we're gonna kind of approach what we really want. And we're going to figure out a way how to make it right. Right? In other words, this is the bullseye. This is the answer that we're looking for. Let's now make it the answer we're looking for. Okay? There's no really a sense of objectivity. So the Chassam Sofer was concerned that these differences in custom, even everything, were shading everything. That these grays were getting in the way. So he had this an interesting expression called Chadash Asur Min Torah. Where that comes from is actually has nothing at all to do with what we're talking about. Literally, what chadash means new, something new. Okay, asur is forbidden from the Torah. What that means, the relevance of that phrase, it comes from a Mishnah. We had davened already. It comes from a Mishnah, but it talks from a Mishnah about in Pesach. You know, after Pesach, you can't take chadash, you can't take new grain. Has to be yashan, has to be old grain from the previous year. But he used that phrase, that specifics are not important for us, but he used that expression to talk about here, talk about what we're talking about. You know, even though it's perfectly permissible to be mechadesh, to make new ideas and new thoughts, we're going to have to take away that privilege because people are slipping away. So therefore, chadash asur min haTorah. He put a blanket almost end game on innovation. You couldn't do things differently, even though there's no reason not to. So I'll give you a couple of very good examples. One, you know, is violated here at Ashtara, but it's not violated because it's not a problem. Where is the bima? I'm sorry.
No.
Everyone agrees it has to be mechitza. But where is the bima? The bima in most Orthodox shuls is right in the middle of the shul, not in the front of the shul. Mm-hmm. Okay? Virtually all, usually in a platform, but not always. Okay? I mean, it's always on a platform, but it's usually elevated on the platform. Mm-hmm. Usually it's like you have to walk up to it, right? Okay? That's true in Young Israel, right? In Hancock Park. It's true in Young Israel in Beverly Hills, if you remember. The Young Israel Central City also, right? It's true with Beth Jacob. I remember Beth Jacob. You have that elevated platform there. Not elevated, but on a bima, you know, Bessishul and JLE, right? It's always there in the back, somewhere, right about in the middle. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's based on the mizbeach kind of being in the middle of the Beis Hamikdash. There's no similarity. People know you never read in the Sefer Torah on the mizbeach. That's where kabbonos are brought. Okay, but it's kind of based on some like example. There's nothing in the Torah. There's nothing in the Gemara on that it has to be there. But that's the custom that developed over the years. Okay, he said, you cannot put anywhere else. You can't if you walk into a shul. He said that's in the front. You have to walk out of that shul. It's not a kosher shul. There's nothing in it in the Torah. Where does he come from? There's nothing. He made that up because he said, I'll challenge. At the time that he wrote it, I'll challenge you to find one kosher, you know, kehila that has it anywhere other than the middle. So chadash asur min haTorah. That was his claim to fame. He said, because he's saying that as a gezeira, because the next time you walk into something and it's somewhere else, guess what? That's probably a reform rabbi is taking over the shul, and he's like taking you who knows where. He's taking you for a ride. He was trying to protect, you know, what we had. Okay? That was one example. He also, it was usher to get married indoors, because we always get married outdoors. And I got married indoors, you know. So you know, but I wanted to get married outdoors, but the various factors, we got married indoors. There's nothing usher. It's a perfectly. I'm thank God I'm married. It's a perfectly legitimate marriage. There's no isser. I don't have to chop al chetz. Hi.
You guys locking up? Because we're out of here.
Yeah, we'll be locking up.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Thanks. Good night. That's just two of many, 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 many examples. But you get the idea. You get the picture pretty much. We'll be, I'm sorry, we're late. We'll be finishing up. Yeah. Clear?
Yeah.
Okay, so I kind of like wanted to bring that up. The other example. Very good. So another one is dress or appearance, right? We dress pretty much, men dress in suits these days, right? That's not, you may notice that some Europeans, some people, you know, Hasidim will notice usually it's Hasidim, but even non-Hasidim Hungarians took the longest time to change their garb. Same thing. So Hungarian Jews, observant Hungarian Jews, tend to the shita of the Chassam Sofer, this general outlook, and one of the varying differences that comes to this very day is there's, you know, Rav Moshe Feinstein is someone that, you know, people in America follow very closely, very carefully. The people of Hungarian ancestry, or if they're from Hungary themselves, often will follow a sefer by called, I had it here, I didn't write it down, so I have to remember, it's called the Minchas Yitzchak, which is by
Yitzchak.
Yeah, what's his first name? Yitzchak, right? Very good. But then forgot his last name. Minchas Yitzchak is a contemporary of Moshe. He was an Ifter about 20 years ago, I think. And he was Hungarian. Hungarian stock, lived at the end of his life in Israel. It's a brilliant halakhic book, but there's a huge difference. You open it up, he quotes everybody. He quotes, like, Achron, Achron, more Achronim, and more Achronim. And that's Hungarian style, because you don't make sure that you're trying to minimize any challenges or any differences with any opinions. And that's typical Hungarian approach. So when talking about, you know, you want to not hunting for a rav, you got to be very careful, because sometimes it'll appear to be very machmir, that approach. Other times it'll be very makel, that approach, because it's a different outlook. Mm-hmm. It's a whole different outlook. So one has to hold by whatever outlook one is looking for. Okay? To this very day, you have different shitas, different approaches coming in from different directions. And that's why it's so very clear where, you know, now there's kitzur this, abbreviated. That's kitzur means abbreviated. Okay, so there's the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, that's Hungarian, so be careful. Even though that's very abbreviated, the standard Ashkenazi approach is not often hold up by that. Even that's the most translated of all the Kitzurim. The Mishnah Berurah is a Kitzur, the Chai Adam is a Kitzur, others Kafachaim, a Sephardi Kitzur. So there's many Kitzurim of abbreviated Shulchan Aruch, how we hold, bum, 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 bum. And that's very delightful and very easy to get hold of. It skips all the middle steps because it tries to teach we ignoramuses what we need to do at the end of the day. Right? But very carefully, you have to know where these people came from and who were their masters and who were their rav and who caused them to have the shita that they held. And that explains a lot of their different approaches. Okay, so that's all I have to say today, and we're done for the whole series.
Thank you very much.
Sorry I went a little late, but I wanted to kind of make sure I got these last little points here because I think it helps. It hopefully helped me a lot in understanding approach to halacha and understanding how different people come into it in a different fashion.
Are you giving over from Rabbi Wein?
I just mentioned that in this class in particular, I wanted to use a couple of his ideas just from that 17th century
Danish. Part.
Yeah, just that one part of it, too, because I think he explained it so well. Yeah, but no, this was Rabbi Berkowitz, Yitzchak Berkowitz.
Yeah, because Rabbi Wein actually had that, 16, I think, starts in the 1600s.
Right, but that's a